MacCast, Wednesday, May 24th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you're having a great week. Mine's been a little rough. There's been a little things happening here at the household, but nothing serious, nothing too much to be worried about. Just some of the typical bumps and bruises that happen in this thing that we call life. But I hope your day and week is going really, really well. We're going to be getting into some Mac and Apple news. I've got a number of great things to talk to you about. We're going to talk about Apple Watch and smart bands. We're going to take a look at third-party apps losing some access to iCloud. I'll explain in a little bit the updates that are looming for WWDC, including possible iPads and maybe Macs. We'll talk about that a little bit. Apple making some changes at the Apple retail store. More on iPhone 8 and maybe what's next beyond that. We've got a few international stories and things like that, and that should round out the news. And then we're going to get into some feedback. I want to talk to you a little bit about hacking and protecting yourself, because that's been going on a lot lately in the news, and also just about the general attitude we have in our community surrounding security and hacking and malware and those sorts of things. I think we need to change our perspective a little bit. So we'll talk about that. There was a patent troll story that came out this week that I want to tell you about something that I think a lot of people covering it was missing. I think that's pretty important. Don't toss out your old peripherals. We'll explain why you don't want to do that. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Siri and artificial intelligence, a conversation we started on the last episode of the MacCast. So should be a lot of fun, lots of great things to get into. But before we get going, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you today about PDF Pen, actually a new version of PDF Pen, PDF Pen 9. If you've been a MacCast listener for a while, you know that I do not own a Mac that doesn't have a copy of PDF Pen installed on it. I think it is a great app. There are so many times when I need it, when I use it. Let's face it, a lot of the documents that we get, if you want it to be truly cross-compatible, PDF is usually the format that people are going to go to. Yeah, we can send Word files back and forth and you can open them in Pages. People still do that, but PDF has really become the de facto standard. And when I need to edit or annotate a PDF for a project I'm working on, it's PDF Pen. If I need to fill out a form, especially like fake forms, these are the things where it's a PDF form, but it doesn't have the PDF form fields in there, so you can't fill it out digitally. PDF Pen lets me put those in there and I can fill it out just as if it had been an actual PDF form, and in addition, I can add my signature to it if I need to do that. So I do that quite frequently. Annotating stuff is important when I'm going back and forth between myself and my clients and things like that. So one of the things I love about Smile is they're constantly making improvements to their software. They never rest. They're amazing. And a lot of the features they add, I don't even realize that I needed them until they add them. And then I'm like, oh, well, how did I live without this in there? And they just launched PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro 9 back in April, and it has a ton of these new enhancements and features. There's actually a video on their website that you can check out. So when you head to smilesoftware.com/MacCast, be sure you click on the more info, and they've got videos and highlights of a lot of the new features. There's a full list there, but I wanted to tell you about a couple of my favorites. Enhanced annotations, you now get a sidebar that shows all of the annotations in your documents, including the highlights, text boxes, comments, notes, attachments. Everything's right there, and you can just simply tap on them and jump right to that annotation. So it makes finding them, organizing them, knowing what's going on with annotations in your document a lot easier. Linked files, this lets you actually add links directly to another page in another PDF file stored on your Mac. So if you need cross-reference or put links between different PDF files, that's really, really handy. And then they added a bunch more export options, especially for things like TIFF, JPEG, and PNG formats. You can do those in color or grayscale. And you can now export as flattened PDFs, meaning that you can prevent any editing of annotations, things and of things that you've added, like signatures. So if you want to protect that stuff, you can flatten that PDF and during export. So a bunch of great features. That's just a couple of the dozens of new features, actually, in addition to over 100 other usability improvements. So like I said, they're constantly making it better. If you're already a PDF Pen or a PDF Pen Pro customer, you can get upgrade pricing. And for new customers, pricing starts at just $74.95, which is a great price for a really powerful app. And there's a free trial available. So you can go and try it out, make sure it's going to work and be the right thing for you before you buy. But I'm telling you, in my opinion, it's hands down the best PDF editor for the Mac. And you can get all the details and more information at smilesoftware.com/Maccast. That's smilesoftware.com/Maccast. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the show. We're going to kick things off today talking a little bit about Apple Watch. There was a report out from BGR. They claim to have sources close to Apple who claim the company is working on these new smart band accessories for an upcoming version of the Apple Watch. And the piece, they focused mainly on one of these bands. They said it was a glucose monitoring band. So one of the big things that Apple has supposedly been working on is getting glucose monitoring into the Apple Watch. A lot of people, unfortunately, suffer from diabetes, and monitoring your blood glucose gets really important. There's actually other good reasons for health for monitoring that as well. As a matter of fact, CNBC cited a source who said that Tim Cook had been wearing a prototype of a glucose tracker, and he even actually commented on that. They noted he was wearing it back in February. It wasn't clear if it was one of Apple-designed ones or just a third-party one that exists on the market. There are some third-party trackers that you can attach to your body, and they connect via Bluetooth to your Apple Watch, and you can monitor those things. Cook said the goal at the time was trying to understand how diet just affected his glucose levels and making changes so that he could keep those levels more consistent. It's just for general health reasons. But more importantly, for sort of those people who suffer from conditions where they need to monitor their glucose, Apple is really interested in trying to get this integrated into the Apple Watch, at least according to some of these rumors. And it's certainly not the first time that we've heard about this idea about Apple maybe doing a smart band. So rather than actually building the sensors and the technology directly into the Apple Watch, you'd have swappable bands that would have different features and functionality. And some of them may be health related, some may not. But Apple reportedly has teams of biomedical engineers and doctors working on all kinds of non-invasive sensors. I think oxygen blood levels was another one that had been, you know, sort of thrown around. So they're working on these things. And the idea is that these bands could give you customized add-on functionality without driving up the base cost of the watch. So in a lot of ways, it makes a lot of sense. And it's possibly a creative way around getting around the issue of needing to put the actual Apple Watch through FDA approvals. Some of these sensors and things like that, some of these things would fall under the realm of medicine. And so potentially Apple would have to put some of these smart bands, I would imagine, through FDA approvals. And that way they can keep the watch kind of nimble. And if it takes a little bit longer to put a band together, one of these accessories, then doesn't really impact the release cycle and the features that would go into the watch itself. Now, how these things will connect, a lot of people think it may happen through the diagnostic port that's currently on the Apple Watch. Apple could use that potentially for future connectivity. It's unclear exactly how that would work, but that port does exist there. There have been rumors, too, that it wouldn't just be health features that would be built into these smart bands. It could be things like a smart band that would allow for more battery life, or maybe one that has an integrated camera. So they really could open up the entire platform in a lot of pretty cool and creative ways. And one thing that I like about it is it gives you the ability to kind of customize the functionality of the watch for the user. You know, not everybody maybe needs extended battery life, but maybe you want some other kind of feature that might be built in. So now I'm starting to think, you know, what other kind of smart bands would be really interesting? I can't think of any off the top of my head, but you probably have a couple you can come up with. So if you like this idea, let me know what you think. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. If you use a third-party app that accesses your iCloud data, things like your calendar or your mail accounts, you may have received an email from Apple this week. They are notifying users that they are going to be changing the policies for third-party apps in terms of how they access iCloud data, and that they are going to be requiring you to enable two-factor authentication on your account and to use app-specific passwords. That, again, is if you're not using Apple's built-in apps. And while this may seem at first like Apple kind of bullying those apps, it really comes down to Apple trying to take a harder stance on protecting your data and privacy. The problem is that now third-party apps, if they just simply ask for your iCloud credentials, there's potentially a place where those credentials exist outside of Apple's control and outside of your control. So the idea here is that you will be able to better protect that information when the third-party apps or their servers might get breached. And this is a problem that has come up. If you've been listening to the MacCast over the last couple of years, you know this is coming up more and more frequently, where some third-party app system gets compromised and their database stolen. Now, a lot of times that data, of course, is encrypted, but the fact that it's out there and outside that control is something that I think Apple is not totally happy with. So they sent out these notifications, and it really only will affect you if you haven't already enabled two-factor authentication. As you know, if you're running two-factor authentication on your iCloud account and you're using a third-party app, for example, I use the Spark email client, you have to go into your account and actually generate an app-specific password for that. Or if you use Fantastical, which is another application that I use an app-specific password there. When this change is happening, it's going to be happening on June 15th. So just be aware of that in case you missed the email, but Apple did send out emails to users. If you want to know how to set up an app-specific password once you've enabled two-factor authentication, it's actually pretty simple. You just sign into your Apple ID account page at appleid.apple.com. You go to the app-specific passwords under the security section, and then you click generate password. And then what it allows you to do is give a name to that password, like Spark email, if that's the one you're going to use for the Spark email account, and then it will give you a password that you can then log in or use to give to that application so that it can log in and access your iCloud data. And I actually take those passwords and store them in 1Password as well, so I have them nice and handy, and I don't forget them. You can always log into your iCloud account and revoke or reset those passwords. So it's a convenience thing for you, because if you hear later that, hey, such and such company had a data breach, and that's the company you're using for one of these third-party apps, you can simply go to iCloud.com, revoke that key and or that app-specific password, and then your data will be protected. And if you've already signed into a third-party app using your primary Apple ID and password, what will happen after June 15th is you are going to be automatically signed out when this change takes effect. And again, the whole idea behind this is actually better security, and I think it's the right move for Apple to make. Sure, it's going to be inconvenient for some of us, at least in the short term, but more and more, I would really encourage you, not just with iCloud, but with any account that you have online, if they allow you to use two-factor authentication or even two-step verification, it's well worth enabling, because you're going to be able to keep yourself better protected. And we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about security and some of those things with regards to hacking and malware and things like that. And again, I think this is an important step, and I'm glad to see Apple making that move. So we were supposed to really have some iPad updates by now. If you remember, at the end of last year, we were talking about all the iPad updates that were going to be coming in the spring, and we were supposed to get this 10.5-inch iPad. Well, that didn't happen, and now it's looking like it may be coming up at WWDC in June. Now, what's interesting about this is that Apple sometimes releases new hardware or announces new hardware at WWDC, at the Worldwide Developer Conference, but oftentimes they don't. So this time around, it's looking like Apple, just timing-wise, the stars are going to align and we're going to get some hardware updates, which could be pretty exciting. As far as what the lineup is going to be, there seems to be some debate in the rumor community about that. We're expecting updates to the iPad Pro, the 12.9-inch, probably updates to the 9.7-inch size, and or maybe a 9.7-inch size. I'm hearing about that, and I'm curious about it for one reason, but also this rumored 10.5-inch iPad. The reason I'm wondering about the 9.7-inch iPad Pro is if they do release a 10.5-inch iPad, it's supposed to be roughly the same dimensions, a little bit taller, maybe a little bit wider, but the idea is that it would have this very narrow bezel design, updated processor. A lot of the other elements would remain similar to the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, so the quad stereo speakers, the display, the resolutions, those sorts of things are expected to remain largely the same. So the fact that it's the same form factor, I don't know why you would still need a 9.7-inch Pro in the lineup. But some of these rumors have said there is going to be a updated version of the 9.7-inch as well. So that seems like a few too many iPads, but we'll have to wait and see. DigiTimes is actually claiming that Apple is already in production of the new 10.5-inch model, that they're producing 500,000 units a month right now, and they plan to increase that to about 600,000 in June. And some recent case leaks have shown up from a pretty trusted source in the Apple leak community, and they do seem to confirm this 10.5-inch model. Another one of the little changes that is a little bit different from the current generation of the Pro iPads is that the microphone holes seem to be moved a little bit to the top edge and also centered at the top on the rear side, which is currently like the iPad Air models, I think. So we are expecting some new iPad updates. The other thing that we heard about, and unfortunately this is going to be sad news for some of you in the MacCast community, is that this could spell the end of the iPad Mini. It doesn't seem like sales are going to stop immediately, but BGR is claiming that they have a source close to Apple who says that Apple's not planning any future updates for the Mini line and that it will be eventually phased out over time. As to why they're doing that, they're saying it's being sized out of the market by some of the other devices, basically being cannibalized by Apple's other offerings. I would assume meaning the 9.7-inch iPad Pro and also the larger iPhone 7 Plus. Now, many of you have pointed out to me, and I totally agree, that a smaller iPad is very different than a large iPhone, but apparently Apple's sales numbers aren't really showing that. Declining sales on the iPad Mini, not a lot of interest, although again, you could argue Apple sort of self-perpetuates this, and I get that. You know, Apple, by not making a new iPad Mini, isn't really appealing to the market very well. So it's a little bit of the snake eating its own tail. Is that how you say that? But that's what's going on. And it's already, you know, on borrowed time. Apple has been dwindling down the options on the iPad Mini. They sell just one version, a 128 gigabyte model, for $400. And that's actually $30 more than the newer 9.7-inch iPad, the entry-level iPad, which actually has a better processor and a better display. So again, by not updating it, I think it's a self-perpetuating prophecy. Maybe that's a better way to put that. But some rumors still have hope for the Mini. We've even heard about rumors of an iPad Mini Pro with a smart connector and Apple Pencil support. So maybe there's a little life beat there, but we're not expecting that to happen at WWDC. It seems to be mostly about that 10.5-inch iPad Pro and updates to the iPad Pro lineup. But I know the MacCast community has a lot of iPad Mini fans. Last time we talked about this, I heard from many of you. So if you want to weigh in on this, if you want to share your opinion with us, I welcome that. Please send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. One other quick exciting thing that might happen at WWDC is a Mac announcement. That is an even rarer thing, I think. I'll have to go back and check the history, but Bloomberg thinks it actually might happen. They say Apple could update the MacBook, MacBook Pro, and possibly even the MacBook Air lineups. The focus would probably be on the Touch Bar MacBook Pros. They would get the faster and newer Kaby Lake processors. Actually, the processors they probably should have had when Apple released them, but they weren't quite ready. So a nice little speed bump there. There also could be a newer version of the 12-inch MacBook with a faster Intel chip. So this is going to be all about updating processors. And the rumor says they could be considering updating the aging 13-inch MacBook Air with a new processor as well. The piece also mentions that Apple has been working on their own custom chip for the MacBook Pro that would actually manage the machine in low power mode, but that might not be ready for this announcement yet. And before you think, oh, that's a MacBook Pro with an Apple processor, the way I'm reading this, and it was a little bit ambiguous in the piece, but the way I'm thinking about this is there has been this rumor that Apple may launch a version of the MacBook Pro sometime in the future where you kind of have dual processors. You have the main Intel processor that would operate when it's in high performance mode, but when you go into the lower power mode, Apple could slip in an ARM-based Apple design chip that would operate in that mode. Sort of the same tactic they take with the GPUs, right? The discrete GPU for high performance, high power applications, but it sucks up a little bit more battery, and then you kind of have the integrated lower power version of the processor for when you're not under as heavy load. And I think that would be a great way to handle and manage that. That could eke a lot more battery life out of the existing designs and also keep the thermal profile, the heat profile, down quite a bit. And let's face it, a lot of us, a lot of times with our machines, you know, you're surfing the web, you're checking email, you're not really doing intensive tasks. So if they can drop that down onto a lower power, more appropriate processor and give you more battery life, that sounds like a really cool thing to do. But that's not expected to happen at WWDC, simply updates to the processors in a lot of the current models. And that would be nice. I would imagine if it's just some processor updates, that may happen quietly. Who knows if they actually even make an announcement about that on stage. It could just be an update to the Apple website and maybe a press release or something like that. Let the news media kind of handle that. But we're going to have to wait and see. Either way, it's looking like it's going to shape up to be a pretty exciting WWDC. We also had heard last week about this rumor about a possible Siri home speaker being introduced and announced at WWDC. So this could be a massive Worldwide Developer Conference keynote with a lot of focus on the consumer side of things. Generally, it's really software developer focused. This time around, it might be a little bit different. Remember, I told you last time about some of the physical changes that might have happened at some of the Apple retail stores. I haven't had a chance to jump into my Apple retail store and check it out, but we had been hearing that a lot of the smaller stores were going to go through kind of an overnight design change to bring them more in line with Apple's new flagship stores, like the one in San Francisco with the, you know, the Genius Grove and the Avenue where the accessories are, where they're using more wood. They're kind of changing up the displays a little bit. I think that's started to happen. They kind of have these feature areas for different products and accessories and stuff like that. And as another part of that change and something, again, that they also pioneered at the Market Street store in San Francisco was something Apple is calling Today in Apple. They announced this back in April. I think we talked about it back then. But they have now rolled the program out to all of the 495 Apple stores worldwide. And if you actually go on Apple's website to apple.com/today, you can sign up for and check out the kinds of sessions and classes that they're offering at Apple retail stores. And I took a look at this, and there is a lot going on. There's a number of sessions going on throughout the day. For some reason, I had in my mind that, you know, maybe they would do one or two sessions a day. No, these things are going on throughout the day at your Apple retail store. They have basic classes. They have these things called 90-minute studio sessions where it's more kind of, I think, project-focused. So you can go in there and talk about video projects or work on video projects or audio projects or art projects, whatever it might be. They even have special classes just for kids, coding, all sorts of interesting things going on, including also entertainment. They're going to have different concerts at certain places, probably poetry readings, book readings, all those sorts of things. And it's all completely free. A lot of it is being taught by Apple's creative pros, and sometimes they're going to bring in special guests, well-known artists, photographers, musicians. So you're going to have to go to Apple's website, apple.com/today, and check out what's happening at their retail store. And they say every day throughout the world, there's going to be over 4,000 today at Apple Sessions going on. And it looks pretty interesting. And I'm going to try and get in and check one of these things out. I don't know when that will happen, but if you happen to make your way to one of the new Today at Apple Sessions, I'd love to hear what you think about it. Do you think this is a good thing? I think this is a great way to draw people into the Apple Store, get them excited about using Apple and third-party hardware that they sell at the Apple retail store. And I think it's ultimately going to be really good for business. Angela Ahrens has come out and said they kind of want to make Apple stores this place where people congregate and hang out and share ideas and spark creativity. And I think that fits very well into the whole idea behind Apple as a company and their philosophy. You know, as they always called it, the meeting of technology and the liberal arts, and really trying to do that in an active way with their, you know, Apple retail stores, I think is a pretty cool thing. So I'm pretty excited to see what's going on. Yeah, they've kind of been doing this with their classes and stuff like that, but now they seem to be really putting a marketing and a big focus on that program. And it'll be interesting to see how it progresses and how it pans out for them. But again, I'd love to hear what you think of this. So send me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Well, let's talk a little bit about the iPhone 8. It's looking like we're not going to get any surprises with the iPhone 8. You know, like it or not, at this point, Apple seems to have very few, if no, secrets about the fall iPhone 8 launch. We're starting to see mock-ups. We're starting to see actual component parts being released. And it seems like it's happening, I guess it's happening kind of in line with production. Right about now is the time that they're going in production. So this is typically the time we start to see this stuff. But I don't know about you. For me, it seems like it's even more prolific. So this whole idea that Apple announced a few years back where they were doubling down on security, I'm not really sure what happened. I think too many people, too many moving parts, too many things going on in the supply chain for Apple to keep a handle on. But, you know, a lot of the things that we're seeing are basically at this point just confirming what has already been speculated, that we're going to see an edge-to-edge screen with the 2.5D curved glass at the edge. You're going to have this stainless steel band, the stainless steel frame, kind of this glass sandwich design with glass on the front and back. A 5.8-inch screen with an embedded Touch ID sensor, something they're calling the function bar area. So the actual screen area is supposedly about 5.2 inches, and then there's going to be this function bar area down near the bottom of the screen, vertically mounted dual lens camera with the flash in between the two lenses, the physical form factor being just slightly larger than the current iPhone 7, so a little bit taller, a little bit wider, but basically squeezing a much larger screen into that same physical space. And I have to tell you, a lot of these mock-ups and designs that I've seen online, I'm very excited about the design. I think it looks really, really, really cool. Additional specs, of course, wireless charging we've been hearing about, faster cable charging. So the Lightning connector is not going away. That's expected to be there, but Apple expected to provide faster charging through the Lightning cable, and 3D facial recognition and or possibly iris scanning on the camera. And it's looking like there might be a dual lens system, not only on the back, but also on the front to enable the 3D facial recognition and some of the other features. So you're going to get that in the front-facing EyeSight camera as well as the FaceTime camera. Did I just mess those up? The front-facing FaceTime camera as well as the EyeSight camera. There are still these staggered and odd leaks that we're seeing that the Touch ID sensor could still be on the back of the phone. To me, at this point, it seems highly unlikely. Most of the rumors are pointing to the fact that the Touch ID sensor is going to be somehow integrated into the front display itself. I don't think Apple's going to want this big, ugly Touch ID sensor on the back. I really think that was kind of the ultimate backup plan, and it's sounding like they're going to push forward. We're expecting to get an announcement in September, even though the device itself is probably not going to ship until late October. It could even be early November. And again, because of some of the new technologies, supplies are expected to be incredibly limited. I expect this to be one of the worst launches for Apple and for Apple customers in terms of availability. I think a lot of people are not going to be getting their iPhone 8 until 2018. And I think there was just no way around it. I think obviously, you know, some people go, why would Apple even do that? And I've even thought the same thing myself. The reality is they don't want that to happen, but they're kind of at the constraint of, you know, what can be done in terms of the technology. And I think they're ultimately making the choice. They're pushing as hard as they can. Hopefully they'll get as much availability in the pipeline. And I think from a sales perspective, it's never really hurt them. It creates this demand that just is insane, right? And people just clamor for it. People are willing to wait for the technology. It creates a buzz. Ultimately, it ends up being a pretty good thing. And Apple's pretty good about catching up. You know, by the end of the year, they should be pretty caught up. And we've seen this with other products like the Apple Watch and things like that. AirPods are still kind of struggling a little bit. But again, it really hasn't hurt sales too much. So like it or not, that seems like what's going to be happening. And pricing, that's still something that is being debated. It's expected that this iPhone is going to be more expensive. Many have said it's going to cost more than $1,000. One report has claimed that it's the 3D touch sensors that are in the new iPhone. They're up to three times more expensive. And that's because there's a difference in integrating it into an OLED panel, because they actually need to embed those sensors between the kind of glass sandwich. So the fact that they're switching display technologies has caused other technologies to change. But I mean, just think about the number of new components we've talked about in this thing. New cameras in the front, new cameras in the back, 3D sensors, laser sensors, brand new display, new Touch ID sensors, new 3D touch sensors. I mean, everything is brand new about this phone. And when component costs go up, Apple needs to recoup some of that. So the base price goes up. So I fully expect that there's going to be a, you know, probably $100 premium over the existing iPhone 7S Plus pricing. And that seems to be where most rumors are reporting. But some hope comes from UBS analyst Stephen Milanovic. Just mutilated Steven's name. I apologize for that. But he said in a note to his clients that he thinks the 128 gigabyte version could actually start at $870 and that the 256 gigabyte version would cost $1,070 US. That would be lower than expected, and would also present an odd price difference because currently there's only a $100 gap between the 128 gigabyte version and the 256 gigabyte version of the iPhone 7 Plus. So the bottom pricing would basically be in line with the current 32 gigabyte version, and the upper version would kind of be in line with the current pricing. And the thinking there seems to be that there would not be a 32 gigabyte version of the iPhone 8. So Apple would have just the two price points. I don't think they would. I'm not sure I agree with this logic, but it would be great if it was a lower starting price. But I really think we're looking at $970 starting price and maybe the 1070, and it could even be higher. It could even be 1070 and 1170 for the new iPhone. So if you are planning on picking up a new iPhone 8, just be prepared that it may cost a pretty penny and you may have a hard time getting your hands on one. Apparently, too, we can't even get an iPhone 8 release before we start getting rumors of the next iPhone. I know it's getting crazy. We're getting way ahead of the cycle, but they're already predicting, and I think this happened last year too, right? They're already predicting iPhone 9 sizes based on speculation of future display deals between Samsung and Apple. Samsung gets their displays from Samsung, or Apple rather gets their displays from Samsung, and they've been in negotiations for parts. You know, now that they've got one deal done, they're moving into production on the current iPhone. They have to start getting ready and ramping up for the next design. So they're talking displays and sizes, I would assume, for prototype phones, for what they might use. And what it's looking like is that Apple is looking at 5.28 inch and 6.4 4 6-inch displays. So the idea would be that you would have this version of a phone that sits between the 4.7-inch iPhone 7S design and the iPhone 7S Plus design. So the one is 4.7, the other one is 5.5 inches, so you have 5.28 kind of sitting in between there. And then you have one that's just massively bigger than the 5.8-inch iPhone 8, or the rumored 5.8-inch iPhone 8. You know, we still don't know if that's the actual size. That's the way we expect it to be, at 6.4 inches. So next phones could be even bigger. Again, I don't know that they can slim the bezels down any more than we've heard with the 5.8 inch model. So a little bit bigger, not overly huge. 5.8 seems to kind of be a sweet spot when it's right in that 4.7 inch physical size, at least for me. So I don't know that I want to go smaller to the 5.28, which I would assume would be even smaller. So some people actually might like that. Maybe it's more like the 4 inch iPhone size with that display. And Apple will kind of cover the full range of various sizes. But again, we're going to have a long time to wait for that. We don't have to worry about that. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about it next year around this time, right? As we get ready to go into the summer when Apple moves into production on the iPhone 9. But it seems crazy to kind of even start speculating on that stuff, but it's happening. So we're talking about it. Another thing that could be in line for a potential future next iPhone is the next generation of cellular technology. Apple filed an application with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, to begin testing 5G technology. It's going to use something called millimeter wave technology, or mmWave. In the filing, Apple said they intend to transmit from two fixed points located at Apple-controlled facilities in Cupertino and Milpitas, California. Right now, the 5G technology is actually a shifting standard. It's not standardized by any of the standardization organizations. They haven't formally classified it, but it sounds like Apple wants to start playing around with it, see what it can do. It actually transmits data at a higher frequency and in a smaller wavelength, between 30 gigahertz and 300 gigahertz, which means it's capable of reducing latency and expanding the overall data transmission. I didn't get information and details, and I'll continue to look into this on the actual speeds, but let's just say it's going to be fast. I mean, 4G is already pretty fast. 5G is going to be amazing if they can pull it off. Some of the other advantages it brings for Apple is it would allow for reduced antenna sizes, and that could allow them to support more powerful multi-band antennas in a single device. So helping with the whole world phone kind of thing, being able to support multiple technologies. An immediate problem for Apple, though, the technology does have issues transmitting through some materials and surfaces, and one of those materials is actually glass. So if the design of the iPhone 8 does end up being a glass sandwich, and they want to use 5G in the iPhone 9, they may have to change up their materials a little bit or actually get the technology worked out so it can transmit better through different kinds of surfaces. I don't know if that's physically possible in terms of the actual physics, because I haven't looked into this technology too deeply, but obviously this is why Apple wants to get a filing. They want to start getting this technology in testing so they can play around with it, so that they can figure it out and have something ready. I don't think they want another repeat of AntennaGate, right? Remember that? That was a lot of fun. You don't want Tim Cook coming out and telling us we're all holding it wrong. But right now, that's kind of some of the things that may be in line for the next generation of the iPhone. Want to finish things up today in the news with a couple of international stories, a few little quickies. Wall Street Journal says Apple has confirmed that its manufacturing partners in India have started domestic production of the iPhone SE. I think we talked about this a little bit on the last episode of the MacCast. Wistron is Apple's main assembly partner in India, and they're starting to put together iPhone SEs. It's kind of cool. The devices are going to actually have an assembled in India label, so you'll be able to know that those iPhone SEs were actually made and manufactured in India, very similar to the Design by Apple in California language that is on the back of the iPhone. So I thought that was pretty cool. Apple has been making this move so that they can comply with some state laws that say companies wanting a retail presence in India must source at least 30% of their goods locally. So iPhone SE production should meet that requirement and pave the way for Apple opening up retail stores in India, something they've been wanting to do for a while. Pricing on the iPhone SE is going to potentially be a little bit of a problem for Apple in India. It's a little bit more price-sensitive region. Apple currently sells a 32-gigabyte iPhone SE for about $399 in India, but the local government is hoping, because of the cost savings locally, Apple will reduce the price. They seem to think Apple could probably sell it for around $299. The thing is that Apple typically doesn't price differently for different regions beyond just doing adjustments for exchange rates or adding on local VAT taxes. But really, the base prices tend to stay about the same plus exchange rate. And the problem for Apple, though, in India is the average price of a smartphone is around $150. So at $400, they're well above, you know, well beyond double the kind of average price. So they may actually have to do something to compete, whether that's promotional things or actually lowering the price, that remains to be seen. So we're going to have to see what's happening there. But at least they've got the production up and running, and that should allow them to move forward on a few things in that region. The Apple Music trial has been free for a long, long time, but it's looking like, at least in a couple countries, Apple is changing that policy. Australia, Spain, and Switzerland, the free 3-month trial of Apple Music is now going to cost 99 cents. It's not real clear why Apple is making that change, but it is something that happened this week. I'll continue to kind of watch this and dig in and try and figure out. I would imagine it must have to do something with the licensing fees for streaming music in those regions. So if you happen to be in one of those regions and you know, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and follow up on a future episode of the Mattcast. But it didn't come up in any of my research, at least not yet, just the fact that it was changing. And one last international news story for you. Jennifer Bailey, the head of Apple's payments business, told The Telegraph recently that they now think that a majority of the contactless payment terminals that work with Apple Pay in the UK are limitless. And what I mean by limitless is last year, a lot of the terminals limited the transactions that you could do contactless to about £30. And technically, limitless is not the actual thing. It seems to be that a lot of the terminals have been upgraded and updated so that now the limit is around £600 to £700 for a single transaction using Apple Pay. I'm not in the UK, so I can't really confirm that that is going on, but I think I've heard from some of you that you're not hitting that transaction limit. Apple says that Apple Pay transactions in the UK are actually up by 30% versus last year, and that there are now 23 banks supporting the service. And I think being able to actually use Apple Pay for more and more things at more and more locations, I think that is the number one thing Apple needs to do at this point to kind of expand Apple Pay, not only in the UK, but also around the world. They also need to kind of, in my opinion, start to change things. Like here in the US, there are a number of places when you get over a certain transaction amount, they ask you to sign or enter a PIN or something like that, in addition to doing the thumbprint thing. And that's a little less convenient and I think unnecessary. If you're doing the thumbprint, that should be enough authentication to actually make that transaction. But those are all policy changes Apple's going to have to kind of work through with the payment providers, with the banks and stuff like that. But, you know, pushing forward, getting Apple Pay and out into more regions and making it easier to use for consumers, I think is really the next phase of Apple expanding Apple Pay. And things like this, you know, raising the limits in the UK, I think are important for making that happen. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to talk to you about hacking and being hacked, really, is what I kind of want to talk about. Because we've talked about all the different ways and different things you can do to protect yourself from malware and from hacking and from Trojans and stuff like that. But this past week, the folks at Panic actually disclosed that they were hit by the recent Handbrake Trojan. And I don't remember if we talked about the Handbrake Trojan, but basically, the makers of Handbrake which is software for doing video encoding, they had one of their download mirror servers get compromised, and basically a hacked version of their software installer was placed onto that server. So between May 2nd and May 6th of this year, if you downloaded Handbrake from the official server, from the official site, that app could have contained a Trojan. So you kind of had a 50-50 chance because, again, it was just one of their mirror servers. And you could have gotten infected. If you see a process, so if you did download Handbrake in that time range and you haven't checked, you can look for a process called Activity Agent in the macOS 10 Activity Monitor. And if you see that, you are infected. I will have a link to the Handbrake forum that has details about the attack, about how they were compromised, and also has instructions for removal of the malware. But that was out there, and the folks at Panic, one of their developers, one of the people that works there, got hit by this Trojan, and through that Trojan, it allowed remote control and access, and they actually had some of their source code stolen. Their servers were compromised. Now, luckily, they say no customer information was taken, no logins for their sync service were compromised, so all of that stuff was safe. But the attackers did try to ransomware some of their source code. They basically said, we have your source code, we're gonna do stuff with it. If you don't pay us, of course, Panic did not comply at all. They posted their blog post, they let customers know what was going on, and they're working to resolve it. Panic assumes that the attackers will probably attempt to create and distribute malware-infected version of Panic apps, probably on a lot of the sites that distribute hacked software or cracked software. So you shouldn't be downloading software from any of those places anyway, but just be aware those things could be out in the wild. They're actually working with Apple to disable any illegitimate versions that may pop up online. So they're on top of it, right? They came right out, said, hey, this happened to us. But the reason I really wanted to share this story is it just goes to show the folks at Panic, they are some of the smartest technology people in the world. These guys know how to protect themselves. They do all the right things. And they weren't doing anything wrong here, right? They needed a piece of software, a video encoding software, for whatever reason. Handbrake's a great application. I've recommended it many times on the MacCast. You go to the official website, you download from the official source, and you run the software, right? There shouldn't be any red flags. In this case, there were actually a couple of red flags that popped up for the developer. The first thing that happened was he did try to update the app internally, you know, run the internal update. It failed, probably because of the hack that was going on. Handbrake is an unsigned app, unfortunately. They do not participate in Apple's developer program. So it did pop up and say, hey, this is an unsigned app. Are you sure you want to install this? You actually have to do the thing with unsigned apps, as you might know, when you have Gatekeeper enabled, where you control or right click on it, you say open, and then it will warn you, hey, you've downloaded this from, you know, this website. And it, again, it showed the actual official website, the Handbrake website, but you know, it warns you. And it doesn't even matter that that app was unsigned. Hackers can actually easily get signing certificates just by signing up, joining Apple's developer program. It's $99. It doesn't cost very much. And so they could have created a signed version of the app. But in this case, Handbrake is unsigned, so that's not a red flag when you're installing it. The other flag was that the hacked version of the app, when you did install it, asked for heightened privileges to install things. But with an app like Handbrake, and I would not have, you know, personally, I wouldn't even have even remembered that Handbrake didn't need heightened access, because it does go out and install some pretty low level video encoders and things like that. And sometimes you need heightened permissions to install that stuff. And a lot of apps we install that are legitimate apps will ask for your admin password, right? So that it can install things into certain locations within the system. So none of these red flags showed up. And the point here is that no one is immune to potential attacks. No matter how smart or how safe you think you're being, you could get hit by something. And you kind of need to plan for that. Another thing that happened to my daughter recently, and I've seen this popping up more and more, because a lot of people say, well, you know, iOS devices, those are locked down. Those are much safer. They've got all the sandboxing and stuff like in them. Those are starting to become a target as well. My daughter came to me the other day and said, "Hey, I was on a legitimate website. She was using Merriam-Webster's dictionary, which has ads, and something popped up, and it was trying to install a profile on her iOS device." And for those of you who don't know, profiles are a way for certain apps and certain things to get lower level access to your iOS devices. Developers use them a lot in testing and stuff like that. So if you've ever done any beta testing of an iOS app, you're often asked to install this profile that will allow you to connect to the servers and get updates and stuff like that. Unfortunately, profiles can also be used to reroute traffic, and hackers and spyware and malware are starting to use profiles, and they can be thrown onto a website and your iOS device can be prompted or asked to try and download and install those profiles. So this popped up, and luckily she knows, because we've talked about, if you see anything unusual, come to me, let me know right away what's going on. And we were able to deny that request. But it looked like something that, you know, the average person might say, "Oh, okay, this, you know, I'm on this website, it's a legitimate website, I need to install this thing," and you click OK, and that's it, right? You're now hit. So, you know, all these things that we do for protection still apply, right? We need to continue to be safe and smart. We need to continue to be always suspicious of things that pop up. We need to stay informed. We need to make sure we're reading all of the dialogue boxes and checking all the boxes. But hackers are getting more and more sophisticated. We need to be downloading releases only through the existing app's internal update process or the developer's official website, or from the Mac App Store if the app is stored there. Actually, the Mac App Store should be your number one source if you can get that. But as you know, sometimes apps on the Mac App Store, because of the rules, they're crippled a little bit, and you want the version from the developer's website. So make sure you go to the developer's website. Avoid third-party update sites, because they often wrap their downloads, or downloads there can get wrapped in adware. You know, all of these things that we do are great, but they're not guarantees. They're not necessarily going to keep you 100% protected. And I'm not saying this or bringing this up to kind of scare anyone. Antivirus, anti-malware, you can use that. But in a lot of cases, that may not detect an infection or stop you from getting infected, because a lot of these things end up sort of being zero-day exploits, right? They get out there in the wild, and it's not until, you know, a few weeks later, days, weeks, months later, that they end up actually in the antivirus or anti-malware definition. So you could get one of these things installed and then find out about it later. But the number one thing that I wanted to bring up here is we need to stop this concept, because I see it a lot in our community, of "it will never happen to me," that kind of thinking, because that in a lot of ways is the point when you've let your guard down enough where you might actually get hit. But also I've seen it where we make other people feel dumb or stupid because they got infected. And that was really the thing that I wanted to get to here. And what brought this home was, hey, there's a lot of smart, really intelligent people that are actually getting hit by these things. I've been hit myself. I'm not afraid to admit I've been hacked before. I've done dumb things. My Yahoo account, I didn't have a good secure password on. You know, it was stupid. It was a time when I was younger. I was using the same password everywhere. And it was when I became a huge 1Password fan and started using that. And you've heard me talk about it. But I, you know, I've heard people, you know, tell other people, or even say to friends or family members, "I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you clicked on this thing. You know, that was really dumb, or you shouldn't have done that." And we have to stop doing that, because hackers are getting more and more sophisticated. We need to get in the position of, yeah, that really sucks. Here's some ways that you can better protect yourself, or here's some things that you might have wanted to try, or, you know, try and be more positive about helping each other when these sorts of things happen, and educating, and not doing it in a way where we're talking down to or making other people feel dumb or stupid. Because the problem is if you start doing that, then they're going to stop coming to us to ask for help or to ask for advice and things like that. And we certainly don't want that to happen. You want more awareness going on out there. And if your response is to make people feel dumb or stupid, the concern is that they will stop coming to us. They will stop asking, and they'll make even more mistakes. So we don't want to be doing that. And then the last thing I want to do on this, I think, is I don't want to just leave it at, well, there's nothing you can do, right? There's nothing you can do. We're all probably going to get hacked or attacked at some point. That's not necessarily the case. There are some technology solutions. There is some technology you can deploy to maybe help with this. The one thing about this technology is it can be a little bit invasive. It can be a little bit annoying, I guess, is maybe a way to put it. But it can also be pretty important in terms of at least letting you know immediately when there's a problem. And what I'm talking about is different monitoring tools. Little Snitch is a big one that's great. It's been around in our community for a long time. It watches all, you install it, it watches all of your ingoing and outgoing traffic, and it helps you set up rules about what that traffic can do and where it can go and what servers it can connect to. When you turn it on at first, it does kind of have this training period. You've got to go through and say, okay, yeah, it's okay that Apple iTunes wants to connect to Apple servers and do things. And it's okay that my Slack client, my email wants to connect to these places. And you start training it. You start saying, okay, all these things are okay. And eventually it starts building out a profiles and it has a bunch of really cool advanced tools. You can kind of set up different rules for different locations. I guess at some point we probably should go into tools like Little Snitch in more in depth, but I don't want to do that here. Just know that there's a monitoring tool that you can deploy. And then once it's kind of figured out your system, how you've approved and set up all the rules, you said, okay, these are all the things that are okay. If you get hit by a piece of malware, it's going to immediately alert you because it's there. It's actively, proactively running, watching your network traffic. It's going to say, hey, what's this thing called, you know, really bad adware that wants to connect to this server? And that can throw up a red flag and you can say, no way, block that. So first and foremost, you can block any, you know, command and control commands that might be going out immediately, and so you don't get hit by that. And then also you're alerted to the presence of this thing on your system. You know, now you can start to work backwards and figure out, okay, what happened? Oh, I just installed Handbrake. Maybe Handbrake got compromised. And these kinds of tools are going to allow you to monitor that. Another one is called BlockBlock. It's free. It's in beta. It notifies you when launch time daemons or other persistent software gets installed on your Mac. So BlockBlock, I think, kind of it watches different locations that are on your machine that shouldn't have things installed into it. Or if they do, it tells you about, hey, this app is trying to install this thing in here. Is this something you really want? And I'll have links to all of these in the show notes at maccast.com. And then another tool is something from F-Secure called XFence. It used to be called Little Flocker. And it's a utility for keeping your personal data safe from malware and Trojans, backdoors, misbehaving applications. It basically monitors applications that attempt to access confidential files or system resources and notifies you when they attempt to read, modify, or delete items on your systems. So that would be really good protection for something like ransomware or something that's trying to go through and like delete your files, copy them off somewhere, or encrypt them. Those sorts of things. It will also report on things like access to even your hardware, things like your camera or your microphone. So if those are turned on without your permission, you would know about it. And actually, Little Snitch, the developers of Little Snitch actually have a product for that as well, a less expensive product that will just monitor your camera and microphones and let you know when those are being activated. So there are some tools and technologies you can use here to help better protect yourself and be a little bit more proactive. So just another thing to add to your tool belt. And I'd love to know, you know, what kind of techniques and things you're doing to better protect yourself and how you're helping your friends and family. So if you have some stories to share with me, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk about the patent troll story that came up this week. You may or may not have seen this story, but it came up because Apple has often been embroiled in these patent lawsuits along with other technology companies. And I think we've talked about patent trolls and patent lawsuits and stuff like that in the past on the MacCast. But basically, here in the United States, there is a couple different jurisdictions where when you file a patent dispute case, the jurisdiction, the courts are a little more favorable to the plaintiff, to the person filing the complaint. And one of these locations is Tyler, Texas. And a lot of lawsuits are filed there. Patent dispute suits are filed there. And it's because the courts are favorable toward the person filing the suit. And it's something that has kind of plagued companies like Apple or Samsung or Google or whoever it might be, because a lot of times these companies aren't doing anything other than buying patents to sue companies to get settlements. They're not using the patents. They never have plans to use the patents. That's the very definition of a patent troll. Well, something happened this past week. There was a Supreme Court decision where they decided to make a change and say that U.S. companies may only face patent infringement lawsuits in the jurisdiction in which they incorporate. And so for Apple, that means California. And so a lot of people were very excited about this change, about this decision, and rightly so, because it's pretty significant for a lot of these patent lawsuits. It means that, you know, places like Tyler, Texas, that might not be the only place where the suit can be filed, and it may not be able to be filed there at all if the company is incorporated in a different location. A lot of corporations in the United States, for various reasons, incorporate in Delaware. And so some of the stories were saying, well, now Delaware could get overwhelmed. But, you know, a lot of the stories as it relates to Apple were saying, oh, this is great. Apple's going to be able to have their patent suits settled and fought in the courts in California. And that may happen, but it may not. There was a big part of this story, at least with regards to Apple, that was sort of left out of a lot of the reporting. And that was the fact that there was a second part to the text of this decision. I think it came out of Judge Clarence Thomas, if I'm not mistaken. And I actually went and read the text after I saw a few websites, only a handful. Like, most were reporting, oh, this is a great win for, you know, people who hate patent trolls. But a few pointed out the fact that there is a critical or part of the decision text, and it's actually right there in the first paragraph. And the text, the full text, actually reads that any civil action for patent infringement may be brought in the judicial district where the defendant resides, and now here's the or part, or where the defendant has committed acts of infringement and has a regular and established place of business. So yes, Apple is incorporated in California, but I think you could probably argue, and this is going to come down to the interpretation of that "and has a regular and established place of business" part, but I think most people would argue pretty successfully in that the 270 locations where Apple operates an Apple retail store in the United States, those would qualify as other jurisdictions, other places where a plaintiff could potentially file a patent lawsuit. And I would assume also that there's possibly other locations where Apple has sales offices where they sell direct to dealers, distributors, and other non-Apple retail outlets, and you could count those as an established place of business. And I don't know all of those places where Apple has offices throughout the United States, you know, regional offices where they have salespeople working to sell to different distributors and stuff like that in the region. I can't imagine that they're doing all of their sales out of the corporate headquarters in Cupertino. So while this is a good win for those people who hate patent trolls, myself included, it's not exactly as cut and dry as a lot of the reporting in the tech community was trying to make it out to be. And you may have missed that this week. So, you know, one thing we like to do on the MacCast is try and point out, you know, all sides of a story and not just sort of the one slant that you get immediately. And very, like I said, I was a little bit disappointed because a lot of these sites are smart, intelligent websites. I saw this on TechCrunch. I saw this on, you know, a lot of Apple news websites I respect. The one place that caught it and did put an update that I noticed was Mac Rumors, and they were the ones that sort of alerted me to this. So as always, you know, stay diligent out there. Make sure that you kind of read up on all sides of the story and follow those links through. Several, what was interesting was several of the sites had the link to the actual text of the ruling. And the text of the ruling, in this case, it was only about 2 pages long, and it was all right there in the first paragraph. So it was very easy to suss out and figure out, oh, wait, this isn't as cut and dry as is being reported. So there you go. A little bit different take on the whole patent troll news that came out this week. All right. Now I have an email and a comment that I received from Vincente. He has a good tip and a bit of advice on why, even if you've gone totally Bluetooth and wireless with your peripherals, you may want to hold on to those old ones. Here's what Vincent emailed me about this week.
Hi, Adam. This is Vicente calling from Los Angeles. And I just wanted to share a little bit of information that I got this week. It turns out that you cannot have just an Apple Magic Keyboard as your only keyboard. In some cases, you need a USB keyboard. And it happened to me actually twice this week. First, I went on a trip. And when I came back, for some reason, my computer was off. And the Bluetooth had turned off. And the Wi-Fi had turned off. So when I was totally locked out of my computer, because I didn't have a keyboard to type my password, and I call Apple, and there is no way to turn on Bluetooth if you are not fully logged in. So their only suggestion was to send me to the Apple store. So they had to plug a USB keyboard, and I could log in, turn on Bluetooth, and then everything was fine. But then a couple of days after that, my computer crashed, and when I tried to reboot, the hard drive wasn't working. So I tried to start on like safe mode, and it turns out that keystrokes won't work if your computer is not running. So I called Apple again, and they confirmed that, and again I had to go to the Apple store where they plugged the USB keyboard, and they were able to get my computer to work, but just by resetting the PRAM. So it's kind of shocking that they are selling the Magic Keyboard as the ideal keyboard to have when it's not fully operational with the computer. I just wanted to share this with everybody. Thank you so much for your show, and I look forward to the next one.
Hey, Vincent, hey, I guess this is the next one. So thank you for your message. Yeah, I think it's generally a good idea to have backup wired devices like mice and keyboards around. I think the thought is that most people probably have that stuff if they've owned a computer for any length of time. But I think you're right. If you're new to a Mac or new to having a device that, and you just have the Magic Keyboard, which is Apple's solution, it should just work. Now, as far as purchasing a keyboard, you can get an Amazon Basics keyboard for about $14, a keyboard and mouse combo for about $20. So it's not too expensive to buy one and just have them sitting around. I think it's a good idea. I've occasionally had issues where I've wanted to connect a wired keyboard to a Mac. But that said, the advice that you were given by Apple, I'm actually surprised, because in some ways it might have been incorrect, or I guess probably incomplete is more the right way to say it. Because yes, if you hold down the keys before your Mac starts booting up, they might not work. But if you time it right, most, if not all, of the alternative boot environments should work. So things like safe boot, holding down the shift key, single user mode with command plus S, doing the diagnostic tests by holding down the D key, even target disk mode with the T key, as well as resetting the parameter RAM, you know, command option shift PR, or command option PR, is that right? I didn't write that one down. I'm trying to do that from memory. Command option PR. Those should all work. The way, and what you have to understand is the way that Apple's Bluetooth hardware controllers work and activate when you're booting up the system. So the controllers for the Bluetooth hardware actually should activate right after the system finishes all of its self-start tests at boot. And when those are complete and the EFI firmware loads successfully, then the Bluetooth drivers should be ready to go, at least basic ones. And that should be enough to receive keyboard commands. And the way you know that has been done, or you're at that point that all of the self-tests have done and the boot is complete and the EFI firmware has loaded successfully, is when you hear the startup chime. And at that point, the system will take boot variables from the parameter RAM or from keyboard input and pass them on to the kernel, onto the operating system. So what happens is that any inputs that are sent via Bluetooth, via the Bluetooth keyboard before those controllers are active, they won't be recognized by the system. So if you were holding those keys down, they're not going to be recognized because they're not being, it's not recognizing the key press, right? They're already held down. So the key, no pun intended, is actually to wait until you hear the chime, the startup chime, then press the keys, not before that. And I actually tested this with my Apple wireless keyboard and was able to get my Mac to enter safe boot mode, no problem, but I did have to wait until I heard the startup chime, then held down the shift key. So that should work most of the time for most of these scenarios, but again, it's always probably a good idea to have a backup keyboard handy just in case you run into additional issues. If you happen to not have a wired keyboard, but you still have access to your Mac's terminal, so in your case, I know you had to use the commands to actually be able to boot your system, but if you can actually boot the system and you want, there are also actually terminal commands that you can run to actually set the boot arguments in the parameter RAM with, you use the NVRAM command at the terminal, and then you pass in some different boot argument parameters depending upon how you want to start up. So if you want to start up in single user mode or whatever you might want to do at boot. And you can reference these. I'll have a link to a CNET article that has instructions and has the different boot commands, the boot argument parameters that you can pass to that. If you want to check that out, just be aware that once they're set until the parameter RAM is cleared. Now you can run a command to unset them, but probably the easiest way to unset them is to simply zap the parameter RAM, hold down command option PR at startup until your Mac reboots or you hear the chime again a second time. I usually let it go a couple times, and that should clear out the parameter RAM and get rid of any of the boot argument parameters that you had set from the command line. But that should do it. You should be able to actually use a Bluetooth keyboard, including Apple's smart keyboard, to do all of those commands. So I'm not sure why Apple didn't know that, or the people that you talked to at Apple didn't actually know that. And while we're kind of on this topic of, you know, reasons to keep maybe older technology around, I think it's not just mice and keyboards with our older Macs. You know, sometimes it's handy to have an old monitor. Like I have a really old sort of 15-inch monitor lying around just in case I need to use it at some point. Just kind of backup tech, right? Older Macs in case you have a Mac that needs to go into the shop. I'm actually dealing with a client right now who had to have her main computer go in for repair, and it's going to be gone for a week. And luckily she has some older machines and backups that she can boot off of, or at least have access to the files from her old system from her backups so that she can continue to work while her Mac is in the shop. So a lot of us, a lot of times we'll turn around and sell our Macs or get rid of them. It's maybe not such a bad idea to maybe keep it around, repurpose it. That's what I do. I have a lot of machines that I can use as backup machines, but they've also been repurposed. So they're not just sitting idle. Some of them have been handed down to my kids. I use others as servers. Like I have an old Mac Mini that's many times been my backup computer when my main Mac had to go in the shop. And that's used as a Drobo server on my network. It's hooked up to a Drobo and I do backups to it. So having those around, older hard drives, you know, you replace a hard drive and maybe get a bigger one. I'll take those and I'll put them in external enclosures and use them as extra storage. I don't necessarily trust them as like primary storage devices. I make sure whatever I put on there, I also have backups other places. But it's good if you just need some extra storage space, or if you're just going to use them to maybe shuffle files around or something like that. Or I'll drop them into the Drobo and use those as extra storage drives. And since there's redundancy built in there, I don't worry about them too much. You know, typically hard drives, after a certain number of years, 3, 5, maybe longer, I start to not trust them as much because they are mechanical things. And we're talking about mechanical drives, not solid state drives. But even solid state drives, right, you have limited number of write cycles. So, you know, keeping older hardware around, sometimes it can be inconvenient. You know, you don't want to have a lot of clutter, but maybe keeping a couple of key pieces around isn't such a bad idea. And your voicemail kind of got me thinking about that, Vicente. So thank you for sending that along. Last time on the MacCast, we were also talking about Siri a bit and artificial intelligence and the ways that Apple will need to kind of make Siri smarter if they do intend to release this rumored Siri Home Assistant speaker device, you know, something to compete with the Amazon Alexa or the Google Home. And we were going back and forth on a couple different things. I mentioned that a lot of, I think, the things that they need to work on improving is Siri using other data to kind of figure out and understand context, meaning, you know, things that might be written in my emails or stuff that's on my calendar schedule or my location, you know, bringing in kind of other data to make her smarter. And Neil wrote an interesting email to me this week. He sent in several examples of where he had asked Siri for information. And I think we've all been through this. You ask Siri for information and she perfectly parses your language, right? She gets all of the text right. But then the response that you get back is just really odd. I don't have any direct examples, but I'm sure we've all experienced where you'll ask about one topic and her reply is for something completely different. And sometimes it's just the wording, like similar words, but other times it's just like we're kind of coming from left field. And of course, many of us have received the, hey, I didn't have the answer, but here's some information I found on the web, right? Which makes it seem like that's kind of a cop-out. They didn't really, as an assistant, you really didn't do your job. You didn't find me the information that I was looking for. But Neil was kind of pointing more to these incorrect responses where the context or the language is right, but the way that she parsed or processed what information you were asking for just ended up being incorrect. And he brought up that, you know, a really good way to that Apple could immediately make Siri smarter is if when you got one of these responses, there was a button there to allow feedback. So not just, you know, having to take your information and email apple.com/feedback or go to apple.com/feedback and fill out the form. Right then and there, where you could click a button, it would start to capture the information. They would already have immediately the audio that you fed to Siri, plus the text response and the text information. So all of that could be gathered up. And then you could fill out a simple form saying, okay, this was what I was trying to do in this interaction with Siri. And you can see here's the result that was incorrect. And maybe here's what I was expecting to get back. So I was asking for the distance to the moon, and what she gave me was the distance to Moondoggy's Cafe down the street from me, and that really wasn't what I was intending to do. And then immediately send that feedback, and then that would sort of close the loop, and they could look at the number of times and the ways that she's misinterpreting information, and then adjust the algorithms and adjust the programming and adjust the intelligence to make that a little bit smarter. So just basically a simple little button that would allow you to submit a ticket. And it is kind of odd that such a thing doesn't exist. I mean, you do have the ability to correct the text, right? You can tap the edit. So if the speech translation is incorrect, you can fix that. And that is fed back, as far as I know, into the Apple brain, right? Into the logic and used to make Siri better understand your speech. As a matter of fact, I think it's even put into the personal version of your Siri brain, and she starts to learn your tone and your inflection and all that stuff based on your fixes to her text. And I don't know that a lot of people know that. So if you do get a response from Siri and she's just misinterpreted a word, so got the word wrong because of whatever reason, you can tap on the screen to like edit that and correct her. But this would be more about correcting the, you know, the logic in a lot of ways. And I thought after Neil sent me his email, it would also be great if the similar sort of feedback loop system could work with all voice commands. Because oftentimes when this happens to me, I'll be driving or not, I'll be using Siri because I don't have the ability to use the keyboard or to key something in. So I could imagine a scenario where you issue a voice command, Siri responds with an incorrect response, and you simply give another command like, Siri, you misunderstood me. And then she could respond back, oh, I'm sorry. please explain my error and let the and I'll let the engineers at Apple know about it. And then you could simply explain what went wrong in an audio response, and that audio could be bundled up and sent to Apple's support team. And if they're really good, they could probably even build an artificial intelligence engine to kind of suck in that data and process it and aggregate it with similar data from similar kinds of questions from other users that were misinterpreted and start to get smarter, like learn from, basically Siri learning from her mistakes and knowing about the mistakes because the users, the people she's interacting with, are actually giving responses. So I think that would be a great way. Another idea would be to take all the misinterpreted queries from, so now that you have this feedback loop, you know, when queries come back or she responds with, here's what I found on the web, take those individual questions, anonymize them, and put them into a system. And then you could either crowdsource or hire teams of people to actually go through them, get the correct responses and answers, put those into a database, put those into a learning engine, an artificial intelligence engine, and feed the responses back into that, again, to make Siri smarter. Maybe they're already doing some of this. I don't really know. But it'd be interesting if maybe they even crowdsourced that out to the public and you could sign up to sort of be a Siri intelligence volunteer or something like that and answer these questions. And again, there's odds that some people, right, if you're crowdsourcing it, are going to give the incorrect answer. But in aggregate, if you're talking about feeding the same question, misinterpreted question, to tens of thousands or thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, in aggregate, you should end up with a pretty good idea of what the correct response or the expected response would be from the point of view of real humans, right? So you could weed out the errors and inconsistencies by having a large sort of sample set. And a lot of this is done, I think, in artificial intelligence systems where they have sort of human curators in a number of different ways. And so I would imagine Apple is employing some of that. Maybe it needs to happen on a broader scale. But Neil, I certainly get your point about just a simple way to say, hey, look, this was really weird. Siri interpreted this completely incorrectly. Here's what I was expecting. And, you know, if they get enough around certain topics or certain kinds of responses, they could start to tweak things and make the whole system a little bit better. And, you know, even as I say that, like I was saying earlier, I can't imagine that they aren't doing some of this already. And again, I'm really looking forward if the Siri home speaker actually becomes an actual thing to seeing how Siri has improved. I think Apple works on these improvements. I think they roll out some of them slowly in the background, but I just feel like we're getting to the point where there's going to be a major sort of upgrade to Siri, and it's going to be a major event, and Apple's going to make a big deal about it just because of all of the resources and companies and talent that they've been hiring in the areas of machine learning and artificial intelligence, a lot of the stuff we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. So I'm looking forward to that. And hopefully that's another thing that will come up at the Worldwide Developer Conference this year. So that would be really great. But again, Neil, thanks for sending in your comment. But I think with that, I think we're done. I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take one more opportunity to thank our sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. And don't forget to check out PDF Pen 9. I was going to say 6. PDF Pen 9 for Mac and PDF Pen Pro 9 for Mac. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications at smilesoftware.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I love your comments, your questions. It's actually what makes the whole MacCast work. So if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you want to use Skype, you can leave voicemail on Skype as well. My Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. The forum's picking up again. If you have technical questions, a lot of the things I get in email would be great questions for the MacCast forum. So don't forget to use that as a resource. It's part of the MacCast community, and there's a bunch of great, smart people over there answering questions. And we just upgraded the system, so there's a lot of great new features. We have two-factor authentication, so you can keep your account secure. And there's also a whole point voting system, so you can vote up and down on questions and responses and earn credits and try and be the leader for the week, answering the most questions and helping the most people. It's actually kind of cool and fun. So if you haven't been on the forum in a while, check it out, forum.maccast.com. And then finally, if you want to follow me online on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the Fast MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community, google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.